I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to Off the Beaten Track podcast. It's another week, therefore it's another episode. My name's Stu Whiffin, I'll be your host today. And joining me today is Tom Whitwell. Tom is a journalist, essentially. He was the former editor of Digital for the Times. He was the editor of the Music Thing. He was the editor of Mix Mag. He was the deputy editor of The Face. So, with them kind of credentials, we knew that we was going to have a good chat about music, and Tom did not disappoint. Had a huge knowledge of music, and definitely had me on the back foot as well. There was a few things where I just thought, God, I've not heard of that. So it's always nice to have your music knowledge tested. Before we get on with the episode, a big shout out to Scroobius Pip and everybody at the Distraction Pieces Network. Thank you to 76 for producing this podcast. And also, if you enjoy this podcast, there's a Spotify playlist to accompany it with all the tracks that the artist picks on there. As well as that, I have a Patreon page, which is essentially like a kind of crowdfunding type Kickstarter thing, but basically all it means is you can sign up for a month at a time, and I put out 4 episodes a month outside of my usual Friday releases. So each week you get a standalone episode over on Patreon. You can find out all about anything to do with Off the Beaten Track at offthebeatentrackpodcast.com. And as well as that, if that's still not enough podcasting for you, go and have a look at www.podbiblemag.com. Podbible is the magazine that is set up, owned and run by myself, Scroobius Pip, and Adam Richardson. Adam does the artwork for the Off the Beaten Track podcast, if you're wondering who Ad is. And we have been going over a year now. It's a print magazine and a digital magazine. You can get the print copies as they now get distributed nationally inside the Sunday Times. You can find out all about this at podbiblemag.com. But we also have a podcast as well, a weekly podcast. It's only a short one. It's about 20 minutes long. And we have all your favourite podcasters on there talking about their podcast. And also they recommend the podcast that they really enjoy listening. Like a short magazine show hosted by myself, Pip and Adam. And some of the guests that we've had on there, No Such Thing as a Fish, Kate Thornton, Carrie Ad Lloyd, Jade Adams, the Gossip Mongers guys, Joe Wilkinson, David L., Poppy Hillstead, Johnny Vaughan. Oh, blimey, I'm missing loads. We've literally had a who's who's of podcasters on there. So go and check that out if you want some recommendations of some other great podcasts to listen to. All right, let's get back to this podcast. And it gives me great joy to say, please enjoy Off the Beaten Track with Tom Whitwell. I've got an announcement. Save Our Souls Clothing. www.sosclothing.co.uk. Why am I telling you this? Because they're our official sponsor. Yeah, that's right. Go and check them out because their clothing is off the scale. You're going to love it. So they've decided they want to be our sponsor, which is amazing. And what I have to do is I have to tell you about why they're amazing. So here's a little bit of blurb. So they've only been going a year. And they're based in Southend-on-Sea, just up the road from me. They put the company together based on a love of tattoos and alternative music. And they've worked with some of the greatest artists around the world to produce these items of clothing that are as unique as you lot. All of the designs are printed using biodegradable, sustainable and water-based inks. In addition to that, they only print on garments made by members of Fair Wear Foundation. I mean, come on, great clothing and a conscience. Since going live in April last year, they've seen their audience grow massively and are now selling orders all across the world. And they were recognised by Cosmopolitan magazine as one of the best sustainable clothing brands alongside names such as Stella McCartney. I mean, that's quite a first year, right? So go and check them out, because they've put a lot of love into supporting this podcast and I couldn't be happier. What else they've done is they've given you 15% off. So if you head over to www.sosclothing.co.uk, do a bit of shopping, see what you like, throw it in the basket, and then on the way out, put in the discount code BEAT15, BEAT15, and that'll save you 15% off. Amazing, right? www.sosclothing.co.uk, official sponsors of Off The Beaten Track podcast. Let's get back to that podcast. It's Off The Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whiffin. Okay, we're recording. Sitting opposite me today is Tom Whitwell. Hello.
Hi, hello.
So we've not met before. The office that we're sitting in right now is owned by my colleague Ben, who initially reached out to you many, many moons ago with some music that he was making, and you're going to be chatting to him after this. But for the purposes of Off The Beaten Track podcast, we always start with the same question, and that's the song with the greatest ever intro.
So I found this a really difficult question.
I should say that you've given me a load of answers for every single one.
I've given you three, yeah. I found this really... In fact, I found the whole thing really difficult. And it was really interesting to sit and try and answer a question like that because, I mean, it's an obvious thing, but there is so much... You know, when you look back, you know, I'm in my mid to late 40s, and you look back and think you've got, you know... And actually, when you start looking at this, you've got 40 years of actively listening to and absorbing music, and just the idea of a question, what's the song with the greatest intro? Was just like, how could I even begin to answer that? And so the three that I wrote down there, which obviously could be any three other ones. Mm-hmm. So the first one I wrote down was this record, Welcome by Harmonia, which is the obscure, kind of weird, interesting one.
I'm not familiar with this.
So Harmonia are a one of those kind of German krautrock bands of the 70s. Mm-hmm. So they were in a band called Cluster, and people in another band called Neu, who you will know from that kind of era. And in the kind of early 70s, I think 1971, they moved to this completely rural, like a town, a village in rural Saxony in Germany, bought an old sort of farmhouse or something by a river. And they just sat in there making this kind of pastoral kind of music, sort of rock music. And in one of these kind of great sort of legends of 70s music, 1976, Brian Eno turns up. You know, he'd heard about them and had, you know, liked their records before. He turned up and kind of hung out with them a bit and made some music with them. And they made this amazing album called Tracks and Traces, which didn't come out till sort of mid-90s. But when you listen to this record, you hear all these elements that appear in later Brian Eno records, and they were obviously very quite conscious of this. They were like, oh, here's, you know, something that sounds like chunks of U2 albums or just his kind of era. And he went from that on to doing the famous sort of David Bowie, mm-hmm, Berlin records. And this is the first track on the first side of that Harmonia album. And it's a kind of weird, it's weird to say, to describe it as a great intro, because it's literally the most sort of, it just starts, I think it actually fades in, but it's just this incredible kind of peaceful, pastoral piece of music that whenever I hear it, it's like you kind of breathe in deeply and you're immediately taken to a very kind of different kind of peaceful kind of place. And the other reason is just because it has these incredible stories around it. You know, that whole era, one of the people playing on it is, whose name I've now momentarily forgotten. It has, that whole world of Germany in the Cold War, where you had, the country was divided.
Sure.
You had the kind of Baader-Meinhof gang were all connected with all these people. So these incredible stories and the idea of these people who pick up, move away into this kind of pastoral place, and it just all comes across in that music.
Wonderful. I mean, the next one's probably a different end of the spectrum let's keep it in Europe.
So the next one was then, I was thinking, that's a ridiculous to say your greatest intro is a record that literally just fades into the kind of playing. When you think of actual greatest intros of all time, what I've said there was Take a Chance on Me by ABBA, which you can almost not say it without hearing that intro. And I think this was, again, a lot of these questions were talking about when you sort of your first records and records that you of your early life. And I was trying to work this out yesterday, and I would have been about sort of 7 or 8 or 9 when that came out. Mm-hmm. Actually, even younger, 6 or 7 when that came out. And I have quite clear memory of somehow being aware of ABBA and all those records, that one, and kind of giving those records. Mm-hmm. I think probably watching like Swap Shop or something on Saturday morning, and the impact of this kind of incredible, just kind of wall of sound of those records, and the incredible songwriting, and the very attractive Swedish women for a 6 or 7 year old boy, you definitely do notice those things. And so in terms of just that first kind of impact, you start to see records, it certainly is somewhere in the back of my head.
Absolutely. I mean, if you're going to look at, I often speak to musicians on this podcast about the importance of intro and how they may write and, construct their records now with the importance on intro in the world where music is so disposable and quick now, and it's in abundance via all your streaming services. But I mean, I guess if you're going to look at writing perfect pop records, you've got to go some to beat ABBA's output, really, haven't you? And I mean, as soon as I see that, take a Chance on Me, I instantly just think Dancing Queen's an incredible intro, isn't it?
Absolutely,
it's going to be that song that gets, your grandparents.
It's the people running across the nightclub.
It really
anywhere
is.
Anywhere in the
it
world.
Is. But as much as you've heard it a million times, it's because it's just a joyous record, isn't it? And it is.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, all of those records are just, they are just remarkable. I mean, I would never, they are those things that you've heard so many times that you just never want to actually.
Yeah. actually completely. Yeah.
But occasionally they pop into your life at some point, and it's still an extraordinary thing.
Well, you sent me 3.
And then the third one, again, I was just thinking about records that have memorable intros. And so this, one of the I suppose we're again back in kind of 70s, David Bowie world. And the third one I picked was a song off The Idiot by Iggy Pop called Dum Dum Boys, which, again, it's not like a great musical intro. It's not going to grab you on Spotify, but it has this intro with Dum Dum Boys are the Stooges that he's referring back to, and he talks about, it's literally this kind of little spoken word intro with him talking about what happened to the other members of the band. And then it just kind of slides into the song. And in some ways, it's similar to that Harmonia one, in that it's almost physically, you feel the song kind of grinding into gear.
Yeah. Wonderful. Okay, for track 2, Tom, the first song that you remember hearing that had an emotional impact on you.
So on there, when I'm thinking about it, I said, I have a really clear recollection of listening, around a friend's house. I must have been, I don't know, probably 10, 11 years old, hearing Dare by the Human League.
Mm-hmm.
And just somehow that having a very, very immediate... This isn't like a sort of nice, interesting pop record. I'd heard those ABBA records, and but suddenly this was something that was somehow kind of cool and interesting. And the first song on that is that song about... it's the things that dreams are made of, and he's talking about all these things happening in, you know, that you want to do around the world. And just that again, the combination of a great pop record, but this extraordinary kind of production that just sounded like nothing else in the world and just came out the speakers at you.
So what would that emotion have been?
I don't know. That emotion would have just been... you know, it would have been interest. It would have been I suppose it's a fake answer.
Yeah.
It would have been a kind of
curiosity,
but also it's a feeling that there is that feeling about identity. There's something about, you know, there's records that you love and are, you know, like ABBA records are these extraordinary things that happen to you when you hear them, but then. If you are a geeky bloke, and possibly lots of other people as well, there are records that are something about, there's something about an identity, and you're becoming somebody marginally different because you've heard this and you hear something different. Another record I was thinking of for that one, which was at exactly the same time, exactly the same scenario, would have been Frigging in the Rigging by the Sex Pistols.
Right.
Which I'm sure you remember. If you were a child at that age...
How old are you, always, Tom?
I'm 47 now.
Right, so I'm just about to turn 47, so yes, but exactly, I know exactly what you're saying.
So you would have always had a friend at school who had an older brother who had whichever Sex Pistols single it was the B-side of, and it was this kind of illicit, terribly rude thing that you could hear.
What was Frigging in the Rigging the B-side of?
I don't know, I haven't looked it up.
Because it wasn't Rotten singing it, was it?
No. So maybe it was in the kind of...
Rock and Roll Swindle.
Rock and Roll Swindle era could have been,
yeah. Yeah, it was around the time of sort of Who Killed Bambi and it might even have been the B-side of that, I don't know.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was just...
But that was the entry into a naughty grown-up world.
Completely.
But there was not the kind of... Because a lot of comedy at that stage was that kind of adult, you know, Sid James thing. This wasn't that. This was somehow much more... even more carry on than that.
It was your vinyl version of a video nasty, wasn't it?
Exactly that. Perfect, yes.
So whereabouts was you born?
I was born in Oxford, but grew up in Bristol. So I spent most of my time in Bristol.
Okay.
And went to school in Bristol, was there until I left and went to university.
I mean, I should also say you've sent us a few more for this one as well. And I'm sensing a theme already. But you know, do you want to talk about some of the other songs?
So that was the Human League one was a kind of current pop record that I heard with friends. The other thing we had at home was it didn't go in one of those in like a musical family listening to music all the time. My parents would listen to kind of Bob Dylan and Leonard Cohen and that kind of thing, but it wasn't a big listen to music sort of household. But I remember we had a few kind of cassettes, and we had cassettes of a Vangelis compilation and a Jean-Michel Jarre Oxygen album. And I've no idea how they got there. I imagine they must have been given to my parents by somebody. And they were another thing where you just put it on and you listen to it and you were in this completely, you know, those are extraordinary and kind of weird records, but that a kind of 9, 10, 11-year-old can listen to and suddenly go, there's something very, very kind of different in this world.
Yeah.
And so I think there's definitely, there was an element I remember, and you know, haven't listened to either of those records for pretty much since then. But you put them on and you listen to it, and it's immediately something that is a kind of just different from what was, you know, pop music, but not difficult or weird or cool music. It was just something that I think stuck with you. I think lots of people who heard those records, it kind of stuck with them that. Kind of aesthetic, that just that a very different type of music from what you were hearing.
Was you always sort of drawn to something a little more alternative and something maybe more different?
I don't know. I think a little bit, because you, as I said, you're a slightly pretentious, geeky man, and you know, you want to have something that sets you out as having a little bit of, you know, that is about defining your identity a little bit.
And I mean, around the time that we was probably, blimey, 11, 12 would have been Destination Docklands, I think.
Yes, I think it was, I mean, I remember seeing the Houston one.
Rendezvous Houston.
On TV. And, I mean, I think that was a few
years later.
These
are Jean-Michel Jarre
concerts. Yeah, I do remember seeing that, and that just being the most extraordinary thing.
Yeah. Was that the laser harp?
That had laser harp, and had, but it was more the buildings. It was the kind of, it was the... You know, the little geezer in the middle was slightly embarrassing, but the idea of, and I looked at bits of that on YouTube, you know, a couple of years ago, and it was an extraordinary thing, that idea of taking over this entire city, projecting stuff over all the skyscrapers, and that certainly had that just seemed like an extraordinary thing. It seemed like a very long way away from my world growing in Bristol.
I was probably too young to go. My parents would have had no idea who Jean-Michel Jarre was, but I could see Docklands from my bedroom window. So,
wow!
I
mean, see the lasers.
We was along the Thames, but we could see the lasers, and it was I couldn't hear anything, but it was like wow.
Yeah.
Okay, for track three, the song that reminds you of your time at school.
So this obviously, you know, this is another one of how would you try and capture one song out of all that, and I think that was where, again, you had, you know, there's definitely, when you look back at that period, there's a lot of things where you're like, that was something that knowing about that, being interested in that, made you feel cool, made you feel different, made you feel you know, interesting in some way. So you know, the records I put down there were, you know, I remember listening to Prince, and as soon as you listen to Prince, you're this enormous, and Prince was obviously an enormous pop star. I remember I did a kind of schools exchange, went to America, and was astonished to go in America that people didn't like Prince, that he was kind of, you know, held in very little regard, was felt very suspicious, you know.
Yeah.
Your average teenager in a small town in America did not talk about Prince, or didn't like that, it was much too weird for that. But that's somebody who, you know, all through my life would have listened to him, and was, you know, I was able to see him the first time when he played at the Roundhouse, just, you know, probably a year before he died, which was absolutely one of the most incredible shows I've ever seen, because it was purely him doing greatest hits as an entertainer and seemingly relishing it and enjoying it, and literally just showing off to the crowd how he had written far more incredible songs than anyone else. And he would play little 30-second, 90-second, 2-minute clips of everything. and it was an amazing thing to see.
What more would you want from a night out than that?
It was pretty good. I remember at the end of it coming out and just thinking, I'm a little bit sad, because that was something I always wanted to see, that, and now that's ticked off. And I can't think of many people on an obvious kind of band bucket list now that I would want to see, given the way they are now.
Yeah.
You know, you might want to see, you know, you might want to see Bob Dylan playing in the early 70s, but you really wouldn't want to see Bob Dylan playing now.
No.
so many people that's true of.
Yeah.
And to see him in what felt like absolutely as good as it could be at that stage was absolutely just, you know, it was incredible.
Yeah.
Similarly to those Kate Bush concerts, you know.
Did you get to them? Concert.
Yeah, they were very similar in that, again, you would kind of like to play a few more of her greatest hits, but still, it was an amazing thing, and an amazing, just the feeling in the crowd as well. You know, there was even though she was doing a whole run of them, you know, you just had this extraordinary sense of an occasion of kind of just love between the crowd and the audience there. So other ones, you know, as a teenager in, you know, growing up in Bristol, I can again clearly remember being around a different friend's house, and him saying, "I've got this, you know, I've got this record you could hear," and him putting on "Nation of Millions" by Public Enemy, which again, as a teenager, spotty sort of 16-year-old teenage boy, was just an incredible thing to hear, and to hear that, and again, that it's almost that kind of visceral feeling. You can almost still feel that coming out of the speakers at you for the first time you hear a record like that?
And I mean, blimey, if we're talking intros, then Public Enemy's got a fair few of those.
Yeah.
But I think growing up where I did, we was exposed to sort of, you know, hip-hop where you could get it. You know, that'd be few and far between. You know, you'd see the electro albums in the record store windows. Could never really afford them.
Yeah.
And, you know, you'd occasionally hear some hip-hop on the radio, and occasionally you get some sort of not necessarily great hip-hop on Top of the Pops, some sort of novelty. But the first time you hear Public Enemy, it's a slap on the chops, isn't it? It's they're not messing around, are they? And it's like, whoa, this is not like any hip-hop I've heard before. Yeah. This is... I think Chuck's delivery is incredible, and having Flav the Clan just...
Yeah.
You know, intertwined, just works so well. And I got that exact feeling the first time I heard Straight Outta Compton as well.
It was just
jarring. And have you seen Public Enemy?
Yes, I saw them when I saw them in the Brixton Academy.
Oh, wow.
In the Fear of a Black Planet tour. So the tour after that. So it was very, you know, would have been about 17, 18 or something, and came up. And that, again, you felt like that was a very exciting thing. You looked around, whereas most of the audience were also 17, 18-year-old white boys.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
You know, it's like I now have a 16-year-old son, and he goes and sees Tyler, the Creator at the Brixton Academy. And you just think, I'm sure this is really a very, very similar kind of effect.
Brilliant.
But yeah, it was an amazing, amazing thing.
And Sonic Youth.
Yeah, and then at that same time, so it was interesting, you were talking about the way you would see hip-hop was kind of on, it was hard to get or hard to get.
Yeah.
In Bristol, you almost had a sense of a kind of conflict between the kind of indie kids and the kind of hip-hop, which were then sort of eventually morphed into the kind of dance music.
So was this point in Bristol, was this Wild Bunch and...
So they would have been around.
Yeah.
And you definitely had, you know, an audience for that. I remember, you know, you would see people like KRS-One would come and play in Bristol.
Yeah.
And I remember talking to a guy in a you know, popular indie band in Bristol, and you had this real sense of, you know, where's our audience going? You know, some these people coming over and they're all going and listening to hip hop, and it's losing, it's stealing. You know, the cool kids are all listening to hip hop, and they used to all listen to indie music.
Yeah.
And I think that it's really interesting that sense when those kind of those moments when it changes between one.
Yeah.
Something because I remember years later in the must have been the. To early thousands. So I was working at Mixmag, I was editor of Mixmag, and so that was when dance music was the biggest. Mm-hmm. It was everything. So we would sort of write about these obscure 12 inches, and then 6 months later they would all be the top 10 of the national chart. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, Ibiza was the biggest thing in the world. And you just I remember must have been probably, I don't know what year it was, 2002, 2003 or something, when The Strokes appeared.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually remember seeing in, like, I don't know, it was in a gym or on TV or somewhere, seeing a fashion show with guitar music playing in it and just going, what's that? That's something, you know, that's that. How is that happening?
We've
had, you know, nobody would have a fashion show with a guitar band playing in it. And then The Strokes came along, and just really clearly thinking, okay, there is something very different happening here. The idea of, you know, people, you know, fashionable people standing around and dancing to 38-year-old DJs isn't going to be, we're not going to be doing that for a while. And I think you had those sorts of moments happening, you know, in the these kind of indie bands that you'd had all through the kind of 80s, I guess it was the post-punk bands, really, all through the 80s. Suddenly, in Bristol, hip-hop came along, and then, like I said, a couple of years later, dance music came along, and you really felt the kind of plates shifting there.
Mm. How was school?
Good, very straightforward, kind of, you know, middle class, growing up in Bristol. Kind of, you know, you're trying to find what your kind of identity is, what marks you out from other people, I think.
Hello, I've interrupted the podcast again, haven't I? Sorry, it won't take a sec. All I want to say is, the songs that we're talking about in this podcast, if we can't play them, it's just because of the regulations regarding playing licensed music and such. So if you want to hear the songs, just go over to Spotify and search Off The Beat and Track Podcast, and you can listen to all the songs because I've put playlists up for each of these. If you can't find it on there, I'll send links on all the social media accompanying each episode. So you've just got to press that one button and you can go through and you can enjoy all the songs that our guest picks. Anyway, I'll shut up, get back to the podcast. See you on the other side. What did you want to be when you was at school?
I don't know. I think I had a vague idea that doing some kind of journalism would be interesting. But I really had no... I wasn't one of these people who was properly running, you know, successfully running fanzines when they were 14. Or the equivalent now of people who would run, you know, blogs or, you know, sure, whatever. So I never really had that sort of drive and that kind of focus. And I kind of went to school, I went off to university and did politics at university.
Whereabouts?
In Leeds, mm-hmm. Which was a, you know, good place to be in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. And then I came out of that and thought, okay, I've got a college degree, I should see about, you know, journalism does seem like something that would be interesting.
Yeah.
And went and did a kind of postgraduate journalism course. And there was this quite clear path that was laid out for you, that you would do this newspaper journalism course. Then the idea was you'd go and work for a local newspaper, so you'd go and work for, you know, the Croydon Advertiser, yep, or the Bristol Evening Post or wherever it was. And then you would do well in that, and then you'd be promoted up and you'd get to a national newspaper,
yeah,
and that would be your career. And I kind of saw this and thought, well, that seems all right. And I went and did kind of work experience on local papers and, mm-hmm, like, seems okay. I mean, I wasn't averse to that idea.
Yeah.
And then one day we had people from different magazines coming to visit, and the then editor of The Face came in to visit, who was Richard Benson. And he, you know, did a talk, and I said, you know, would it be possible to do work experience maybe? And I went and did work experience, and suddenly, again, this entirely new world opened up, and you thought, well, actually, rather than writing about dog shows and local councils in Croydon, I could be working in, you know, writing about music and writing about bands,
yeah,
and writing about culture and writing about interesting things that we found, mm, you know, and this very, very different world. And suddenly, from that point, suddenly I really wasn't terribly interested in the idea of doing what I was going to,
yeah,
do previously, and thought that actually going and working in magazines would be a much more interesting and,
yeah,
much more plausible,
yeah,
thing that you could do. So eventually left, you know, when I left that, managed to get, you know, did lots of little bits of work experience and writing where you're trying to... And it's funny, when you start out, you have this idea that you have to come up with ideas, obviously. Mm. And you come up with one idea and you hold it so tightly, and you go and pitch it to somebody, and there you see this incredibly experienced, you know, magazine editor who's probably, you know, 26.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
24.
Yeah.
And they go, oh, that's a great idea, but, and then they explain exactly why is definitely,
yeah,
not an idea, and then you've got no more ideas because you had that idea.
Yeah.
And I remember looking at those people and just thinking it was so extraordinary how clever they were and how they were able to do this.
Yeah.
How could they look at an idea and just immediately figure it out and work it out? And it was very, you know, gratifying when a couple of years down the line you realise, well, actually, I've now learned what,
yeah,
I've learned, and you're able to do the same thing, and you're able to kind of have that. You know, that beginning to have that mastery of a,
sure,
of a skill. So it's a very long way of answering
no
where I went to school.
Track four, the first record you remember buying from a record shop.
So this again is going, you're sending right back to kind of youth and this, and I think this is right, but I certainly remember buying it very clearly. I remember going out and buying Relax by Frankie Goes to Hollywood, and having somehow acquired some kind of old, almost like one of those kind of dance set record players with a sort of speaker built into it that somehow acquired from somewhere. And I remember at that time I was listening to John Peel in the evenings on Radio 1. So I was aware of them kind of appearing and that record coming along, and then went and bought the record. And I bought a 12.
So had you heard it before you bought it?
Yeah, I definitely heard it. Yeah.
Right.
I remember buying a 12-inch of it, which had this kind of
amazing
fairly
sleeve.
Kind of, fetish kind of sleeve. And then I was a bit disappointed when I got home, because the 12-inch of it has a 18-minute long sex mix.
Which is that not the New York mix?
It's called the Sex Mix, and it's basically, grunting noises for 18 minutes.
Right. You don't want your folks hearing that, do you?
Well, this is the thing. And I was so, taken by them and by the whole ZTT and by, the way Paul Morley created this whole kind of, ludicrous kind of aura around them and the Trevor Horn production of them. And I'm pretty sure my parents were at that point very certain that I was gay, and I remember having a slightly, really kind of weird and slightly confusing conversation with them, which I think was them saying, "That's fine, that's great, that's fine." And I think, looking back to it, really didn't see it at all.
Yeah.
I was like, "This isn't the mix of the record I wanted. Yeah. I don't really want to listen to this one. It's kind of just boring."
Yeah,
and just somehow completely sort of didn't find it uncomfortable or weird. I mean, I'm sure if you'd said, "Do you understand what this means?" I could have said, "Yeah, I do kind of understand."
Yeah.
But I didn't feel weird about it. And it's again, a very funny thing when you have children. I will now have a record that's got like one slightly weird, one racy lyric in it or something. And I'll feel kind of mortified playing it with the children hearing it. And I can well imagine they would listen to it and just like the record. And you don't listening to Purple Rain. You listen to Purple Rain and go, I guess I can see that those are rude lyrics. But you somehow didn't feel in any way kind of uncomfortable.
I remember Starling Nikki, innit?
Yeah.
I remember hearing, having the album.
Yeah.
And always just thinking, like, if my folks are around, I can't play Darling Nikki.
Yeah.
That's got some rude words in it.
I mean, that's very, very clear what's going on that one, isn't it? There's no possible ambiguity in that one, is there?
I love the fact that conversation with your parents was brought on because of the 18-minute sex mix of Relax.
I don't know. I've never actually raised it with them, but I do. And I was just like, this is just a really rubbish record.
Yeah.
Something like this at all.
Brilliant. okay, so were record shops like very early on an important place for you?
So in again, this...
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
This kind of, and I'm very much looking back at sort of pretentious 16-year-old where you're looking for something that is distinctive and seems like it's a little bit cooler than the next person. And, you know, Sonic Youth, I love, would absolutely listen to Sonic Youth. I enjoy listening to Sonic Youth. Love that record, and it is an amazing, kind of beautiful and interesting record.
Great record.
But there was a record shop in Bristol called Revolver Records, which was this completely independent shop. It had no shop front to get into. You had to kind of go up this little staircase. And there's a wonderful book called Original Rockers by Richard King, which is the guy who worked in the shop. And it's fantastic to read this book, you know, 20 years later, find out just what was going on.
Yeah.
And the business of the shop was extraordinary. He describes people would come in and they would have suppliers who they would buy a stack of CDs from every like 6 months. And Richard going, I mean, we haven't sold any of the last lot. Should we really buy some more?
Yeah.
And it would just build up and up and up. And he describes a stockroom at the back that was just mouldering and gently rotting.
Brilliant.
Kind of just because they just bought more and more and more records. And you would go in there and it was obviously incredibly kind of intimidating as a sort of, you know, little 15, 16-year-old kid. Because presumably looking at it now, there was, you know, 18 or 19-year-old kids. And then, you know, 25-year-olds behind the counter. But that was a place where you went and saw the most, you know, what seemed like the most exotic and weird and esoteric things. But you'd also see things like, you know, I remember there being a Bristol fanzine of these kind of indie bands that had a cassette on the front, and you'd buy that and you'd listen to it, and you'd suddenly again kind of learn this whole kind of world that you could understand and be part of, and it would give you this kind of identity. So certainly Revolve Records very much that end of it, but there was a fantastic record shop kind of scene in Bristol. You had kind of Tony's Records that was more kind of dance records, and hip-hop records would have been in there, and it was a place that you would go and, you know, mill about irritatingly on a Saturday afternoon and not buy anything.
Was you obsessive over music?
I wouldn't say I wasn't a kind of enormous kind of collector, but I definitely think, you know, it was definitely a big chunk of my identity and the way I kind of define myself, I suppose.
Okay, so we're going to move forward I imagine, a few years after you were 16, to the song that soundtracked your time clubbing.
So this was really difficult.
As the editor of Mixmag, you must have done a lot of clubbing.
Well, I went to a lot of clubs, yes.
Yeah.
And
is there a difference from going to clubs and clubbing?
Well, there is, definitely. I mean, there's a... So I was the editor of Mixmag, and I loved the time I was there, and I loved that scene and the way being part of that when it was such... As I was saying, in that sort of early... You know, I was there from sort of... I was the editor from probably... 98, 99 to about 2003 or something. So it was at its peak of that world. But I was not somebody who was, you know, one of the things I was held in great suspicion of Mixmag because I didn't do drugs.
Yeah.
Which was obviously kind of separated me from people a bit. And I wasn't somebody who had somebody who'd been to plenty of clubs when I was certainly, you know, imagine being at university in Leeds in the 90s, there were brilliant clubs to go to and you did go to them. But it wasn't really my kind of core,
sure,
or my identity. And what was really interesting with that question was looking back over that period, there were all these records that I remember at the time being very exciting. And certainly within when you're at Mixmag, you had this cycle of a record would appear and you would hear about it, and then you might actually hear it, and then you'd get a copy of it. And then over this kind of 6 month period, it would be this incredibly important cultural, you know, artifact. It'd be sure. an important piece that people talk about. So a record like Music Sounds Better With You mm-hmm. by Starlight, which was Thomas Bangalter, I think, mm-hmm. wasn't it? That a record like that was incredibly important for that 6 months, a mm. year. And now you look back and you're like, I mean, it's a nice record. I wouldn't especially want to listen to it now. It's definitely a good record. And I, you know, guess within that, you know, there are places where that would be a great record to have come on in a club or something. But it's not as a piece of, it's lost that power of being an artifact and being excited. And I think you saw that. I remember that over and over again. So I would be really, really obsessed by a piece of music or a scene or by something that was happening. And then when you look back at it, you know, almost 20 years on,
sure.
it just, you kind of feel like that wasn't really the core of it. The core of it was that experience going out and the incredible kind of just cultural moment that was.
You know,
stretching all over the world, which is now kind of even bigger probably, but that idea of something that was stretching from, you know, a little nightclub in Essex to some kind of luxury hotel in Miami to Ibiza was just, to me, a more exciting, bigger source of stories and source of kind of memories than often, you know, I can't remember what records they were playing at Manu Mission when I went there, but I can certainly remember going, you know, the times you went to that club. So it was that kind of thing. So looking back at it, it's hard to pick records where you just go, actually, that's a really exciting.
Yeah.
You know, the records I like from that era, obviously, but it was interesting. And until you asked that question, I had never sort of made that connection almost.
Yeah. Okay. Track 6. Favourite song from an artist from your home county?
So this was difficult in that the really obvious and probably true answer would be, you know, if you were growing up in Bristol and you were 18 in 1990, then Massive Attack and that whole, you know, scene that emerged from that was incredibly exciting and incredibly important. And you know, you listen to those records because they were so of that place as well. It's not like it was a nice record that was, you know, a Rolling Stones knockoff that happened to be made in your town. Those were very much records that were very much of that town and that era, and the way they had evolved up to that point. So it wasn't like they just appeared from there. As you said, you had kind of Wild Bunch, and you had Smith and Mighty, you know, and you'd be aware of these interesting records. So people like Smith and Mighty were putting out these great records in sort of, I guess, 89, 90, that sort of time. So you were aware of them and you were kind of excited by them. And then for something as extraordinary as that Massive Attack album to come along, I mean, I remember hearing... it seems like, I'm sure I remember hearing Unfinished Sympathy being played in a nightclub. It seems like not really a particularly nightclubby record, but I'm sure, you know, it was. You know, I definitely remember that. And just going, my God, you know, this is quite a thing.
Yeah.
And so that feels like a very, you know, dull answer, but I think that is the real answer. You know, being able to, you know, it was a very important, you know, again, in terms of music as defining your identity, that was definitely an enormous chunk of that. But again, when I look back at Bristol, one of the things that was interesting about Bristol was there were a lot of bands that were local that you went to see. So the Blue Aeroplanes was another band, you know, the kind of jangly.
Great shirt.
You know, wannabe kind of Bob Dylan-y, you know, spoken word stuff. But again, a really interesting band because they also had a DJ. So they were a great band to see live, and you would see them live all the time in Bristol, obviously. So they were a band that, again, was really important for me in that era.
So So was you like sort of torn then between sort of going and watching live bands, and then, you know, was that whole kind of thing in Bristol with like the, I mean, I'm basing this on what I've read in the books and stuff, and, you know, like the sound system parties and things like that, and you know, was the street art as obvious as it is in the books and the, you know,
so
the tales?
So when you're slightly more on the posh end of Bristol, I was not going to, you know, blues parties in St Paul's.
Right, okay.
But certainly the street art completely was, you know, you would see... I do walk around Bristol and think, behind a couple of layers of whitewash on that wall, there is a 3D piece.
Yeah.
If you could somehow peel it off, I'm sure it'd be worth a fortune somehow. So you certainly saw that. But actually, I was much more the sort of... I was in the kind of indie band scene there. And then there was also that sort of morphed into the kind of, you know, what became sort of acid jazz and that sort of stuff. So there was a lot of that for the white kids.
What other indie bands were coming out of Bristol at that
point? So there was people like, there was the Chesterfields and the Brilliant Corners.
Yeah.
That really kind of jangly.
Yeah.
You know, one of the great things about Bristol at that time was every summer there was in Ashton Court, which is the big park over there, there was this huge pre-festival. So for 2 days in the summer, you'd go and sit in a field with all your friends and watch, and it would be, you know, you'd have, I can't remember what it's called, there was a band that was basically Adrian Utley from Portishead would be playing in one stage, and then you'd have Automatic Lamini, which ended up, PJ Harvey ended up being a member, would be on another stage. Mm-hmm. The Blue Aeroplanes would be over, the Brilliant Corners were there. The Sears were a kind of much more kind of rock band. So there were all these bands coming out, and you did see them a lot. So it was a brilliant, you know, place, I think, to grow up.
Yeah.
Feeling like your kind of local community was kind of important and interesting, and there was exciting things happening. And then that sort of blossoming a couple of years later, when suddenly it was famous.
Yeah.
Was really, I'm sure it's the same as anyone. I'm sure if you were in Manchester in the couple of years before that exploded, you would be seeing all these amazing bands, and then suddenly everyone else was seeing them.
So. Yeah. Yeah, I'm always curious for, you know, when I've spoke to, you know, musicians and such that were doing music in Manchester at that point.
Yeah.
You know, and just speaking to people like Mark Moore and wanting to know about what the Mutt Club was like.
Yeah.
And, you know, what was these moments like? And obviously, when you talk Bristol, you instantly just want to know what was that scene like with the sort of, you know, the sound systems and such. Okay, final track, and you can play DJ now, and you can get to basically let people know a song that, or the question is a song that many may not know that you would like them to hear.
So it's been funny talking about this music from, because almost all the music we've spoken about has been a long, long time ago.
Sure.
And so the last, so I left Mixmag in 2002 or something, moved to The Face, was at The Face for a few years after that until we unfortunately closed it down because it didn't work. And then got much more into, I then started up this music gear blog in 2004, 2005, which was just talking about music gear and the way musicians make music as a kind of, just from a sort of from a fan's point of view. So at that time, a lot of stuff around music gear was incredibly earnest and serious. So the idea was, if you bought a £4,000 guitar with an £8,000 amp, then somehow you would sound amazing. My way of looking at it was, that's obviously nonsense. If you're a good guitarist, you'll sound great. If you're a bad guitarist, you won't. But it's kind of nice to own an interesting piece of equipment. Mm. And the stories behind that equipment is interesting. The stories about how musicians make their records, I find really interesting.
Yeah.
So you had that kind of, so that was writing at that stage about the business of making music. And then after that, I got into designing music equipment and sort of learning how to do electronics, learning how to make things. And you start off making, like, guitar pedals are very, very simple electronically. They've got like six or seven components, and they're quite simple to design. I then got into this kind of modular synthesizer scene that people are getting into now, and started designing things for that. And that was that kind of opened up this whole world of much more kind of weird and difficult and experimental music. And again, it's still going back to being the kind of 16-year-old in Revolver Records in Bristol, and going, I really want to actually understand that difficult and weird music. And I think probably about, you know, 8 or 9 years when it came out, I read a book by Alec Ross called The Rest Is Noise, which is a history of music in the 20th century, essentially from the kind of classical music side. So it starts with Stravinsky doing The Rite of Spring and there being a riot. And it's an absolutely wonderful book because it just leads you through the 20th century in the stories about the way music evolved and the way music became difficult and interesting.
Yeah.
And you get to Stockhausen and you get to Lamont Young and the kind of New York scene that then sort of bled into the Velvet Underground,
mm-hmm.
those sorts of things. And so the last sort of 8 or 9 years, you know, I've just been discovering a lot more weird and difficult and interesting music. And some of it's music that you don't really want to necessarily listen to. So I will read any number of books about John Cage because he's such a fascinating, interesting character, and he had such an extraordinary influence on the 20th century and on the way music works. I don't really sit around listening to John Cage records because they do tend to be quite difficult.
Yeah.
But along the way, I have discovered a lot of music that I really love. So this is finally getting to the point of this. So a lot of that music made by the kind of New York minimalist composers of Philip Glass and Steve Reich, I can listen to all day long. And the record that I've mentioned here is a record by Roberto Cacciapaglia.
Glad you said that.
Which I think is how you pronounce it. I don't know. It's one of those words I've only ever seen written down. No idea how to pronounce it. The record is called Sei Note in Logica, which is Six Notes in Logic, I guess, mm-hmm. in Italian. If you're looking this up, make sure you get that record, which has got a picture of a kind of tennis court on the front. He's got a lot of other records, which are just kind of terrible New Age, which are not good. But this is an amazing record, which I think he made in, I think it's probably about 1978, 9, that sort of year, I'm not sure. And it's a kind of, I guess it's an orchestra, or certainly strings, and an opera singer, and a computer that he had borrowed from kind of IBM or Hewlett Packard or something.
Yeah.
So it's this kind of it's got that sort of Steve Reich kind of minimal, repetitive thing going. It's got bits of this vocal in it, and it's got this kind of bleeps and bloops and other bits in it. But it is just a beautiful, amazing piece of music to listen to. So the kind of that's the sort of there are in that kind of world of difficult music.
Yeah.
What's been fantastic is finding these pieces of music that are also just amazing to listen to and come out of that kind of interesting kind of world.
I mean, what I have just realised is, as we're about to wrap, is didn't actually talk about the song that soundtracked your year's clubbing, what that track was.
Oh, yeah. So it was funny, when you asked that question, the first song that popped into my head was Music is the Answer by Danny Tenaglia.
Mm-hmm.
I can't, in all honesty, suggest that is in some way the best one, or that it is the one that soundtracked my year's clubbing. I don't even remember hearing it in clubs, hearing Danny Tenaglia playing it. I suppose it represented the sort of, you know, I really loved listening to music like that in clubs because I've always had a very, very high tolerance for repetition, and I've always really enjoyed, you know, listening to the same thing for 16 minutes or 20 minutes.
Do you think that comes from the sex mix of
Frankie? Well, no, I didn't like that. Maybe it is. I haven't thought of that. Yeah. But I think that's a great, you know, those are the sorts of records that I really, really enjoy.
Yeah. So,
but I think it's very arbitrary picking that as a record.
Yeah.
You know, out of all of the other, you could have picked any one of other, you know, hundreds and hundreds of records from that era.
like anything, we, you know, I often sort of have these conversations with guests on here, and these song choices change daily, right? It's like whatever mood you're in when you write them down.
Yeah.
I expect it to be different the next day.
Yeah.
Tom, thank you very much. There you go. That was Tom Whitwell. He was an absolute joy. It was, like I said at the beginning, it was nice to have my music knowledge quizzed and prodded. And yeah, he was had a great, you know, obviously if you're the editor of Mixmag, your knowledge of music's going to be great. And growing up in Bristol as well at that time, you know, you're going to get exposed to so much amazing music and culture. And it was nice to sort of ask, you know, what that was like. And I love his honesty that, you know, he wasn't at the super cool sound system parties, because he was from the slightly posher side of town. There's nothing wrong with that, and it's lovely that he was so open and honest about it all. Yeah, really enjoyed that chat. Thanks again to Tom, and thanks ever so much to you lot for listening, and I will see you next week. And remember, if you can't be bothered to wait until next week, get over to Patreon, because there's a standalone episode over there each week. And if this is the first time you've listened to this podcast, go and have a look in the back catalogue, because there's episodes with blimey, DJ Yoda, Sheik, Suede. Oh blimey, who else have we been talking to lately? The Mystery Jets. Oh, there's a real who's who. James Lavelle. Go and have a root around in the back catalogue, in the archives. And better still, click subscribe, and then it'll just pop up in your listening device each week. We're also on the social medias, so if you see us on there, give us a like, love, share, retweet, drop us a message. And you can find out about all of this at www.offthebeatentrackpodcast.com. Have a smashing week. I'll see you next week. Bye-bye. Oh, yeah. Sorry. I've butted in yet again. I just want to quickly tell you about this magazine. It's called Pod Bible. Now, Pod Bible is the new essential guide to podcasts. It's put together alongside Spotify and Acast, and it's a one-stop shop to tell you all about the podcasts you maybe know about, but definitely about a load of the podcasts that you probably don't know about that we think you should know about. I mean, in the first edition, there's interviews with Adam Buxton, interviews with Craig Parkinson. There's features on Jade Adams, and there's just an abundance of information about so many exciting podcasts that are out there. Also, Spotify have given us these amazing little codes. So if you do get a print copy, you can just turn on your Spotify on your phone, scan the little code, and it just automatically opens up the podcast on your listening device. How good's that? If you haven't managed to get a print copy, then just go over to www.podbiblemag.com and read it online, because the digital version is all over there and it's all free. So every other month there'll be a new edition out. So go and have a look and support us on the social medias as well. Podbiblemag.com.
It's Off the Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. Keep me, Stew with him.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.